morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, April 9th, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta. Be prepared, especially if you're in court defending yourself against child molestation charges.
The free Tibet messenger, Lakbam, rides into Portland this weekend with the story the world has turned its collective back on.
And, of course, Trey Arrow is back. And Hans Fostre of Living Harvest will also join the hemp discussion by phone.
Portland area weather. Scattered showers today, mainly the morning, mostly cloudy. Highs around 53. Tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows dropping to 35. Tomorrow looks mostly sunny, highs around 63. And tomorrow night, slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, lows around 43. And Sunday, again, a slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, and a high around 60. And first we go to headlines from around Cascadia. The free Tibet motorcycle ride calls to mind Che Guevara's historic ride through South America. My guest today is Lakpa. He'll be in Portland this Saturday, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning. Greetings, Lakpa.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Tell us why you are doing what you're riding around America. You left everything behind, family, home, the whole works, got on a motorcycle, and you're riding around America. Why?
Not just America. I'm traveling 22 different countries to promote Tibet and Tibet awareness. Tibet has been illegally occupied by Chinese government, and more than 1 million people died. 6,000 monasteries have been destroyed. Nuns have been raped, and monks are not allowed to practice religion, tortured.
So look, say again, give us those numbers. Those are stunning, absolutely stunning numbers. Could you just tell listeners again how many people died?
More than 1 million Tibetans died.
That's a worldwide disgrace that was allowed to happen with very little being done. Tell us more about your ride.
I'm riding to promote Tibet and Tibet awareness. I started on March 10, United Nations. Basically, my ride is to, you know, get awareness and educate people about Tibet, what's happening in Tibet.
And where you're going to be in you're going to be speaking tomorrow in Portland.
Tomorrow I'll be speaking on 6225 Northeast Station, Stanton Street, Tibetan Community Center.
And that's at the Bodh Kang at 3 p.m.
That's correct.
Anything else? We have little time this morning, but anything else you just want listeners to know?
I just want the listeners to know that Tibetan people in Tibet are living in hell under Chinese government. Tibetan people are suffering. They don't have a religious right. They don't have a human right. And they are continued tortured and they're not happy under Chinese government. Chinese are not allowed their religion and freedom for Tibetan. Tibetan people are, you know, escaping Tibet to get religion and freedom outside Tibet. And I live in a free country. I'm basically voice for them. They don't have any voice inside the Tibet.
That's true. Thank you so much for that. We'd like to have you back again to talk more, if you can join us by phone. Perhaps sometime next week to talk a little bit about the tour and where you go next and what you hope to accomplish. But for now, thank you so much for being with us today. My guest has been Lakpa. He is with the Free Tibet Voice of the Silenced People, riding the world's highways to bring the plight of the Tibetan people to vivid life. Thanks so much for that, Lakpa. And we'll have...
Actually, you can visit freetibetworldtour.com for more information if you want to, you know, we'll all go to my website.
That's great. We'll put all of that information, okay, on, of course, on the KBOO website so listeners can find out more about the Free Tibet Tour. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
In a Multnomah County courtroom yesterday, the Boy Scouts of America and Oregon's Cascade Pacific Council defended themselves against a $14 million lawsuit by a man molested by volunteer Timur Dykes. In closing arguments, attorneys for the Boy Scouts vigorously rejected any comparison with the Catholic Church. Still, the parallels seem unavoidable.
Well, they had to do something, what with citizens being gunned down because they were mentally ill and suicidal. So starting Monday, Central Precinct Officer Betty Woodward, one of the first Portland police officers trained in mental health crisis intervention, will be paired with a Project Respond mental health care worker in a day shift patrol car. Mental health advocates and even the police union are leery of the idea.
And here's one from Indy Media. Portland police officer Thomas Brennan was transferred to the property warehouse 5 days after going to the media with his concerns about Sergeant Kyle Nice. Brennan believed his sergeant to be under too much stress to work the streets. He recommended that he be removed from his usual duties. Just a wild guess, but maybe if reports like this were taken seriously, we wouldn't have so many dead citizens.
And ride-arounds are just fine, but perhaps we ought to drug test the police, on not just after a fatal shooting, but maybe on a regular basis before these things happen. Apparently, Oregon's Democrats are not all on the same page as we see. Governor Ted Kulongoski has vetoed three bills the Oregon legislature approved in February. Kulongoski said that each would be a significant change in long-standing policies, and none got a sufficiently thorough airing in the brief four-week session.
Oregon's in the race to become the leader in wave energy technology. Plans are in the works for at least one buoy to be deployed off the Central Coast before year's end. Will the buoys harm fishing, recreation, and tourism? Not half as much as Q-Max tankers full of liquefied natural gas on our rivers and off our shores.
And, of course, liquefied natural gas is none other than the infamous methane that caused a huge explosion in the Massey Mine Company's mine in West Virginia this week. Well, a judge has granted more time for Congress to approve a $3.4 billion settlement against the government for swindling Indian tribes out of royalties for oil, gas, and grazing leases. It would be the last time that U.S. District Judge James Robertson warned that the latest delay is the last that he's going to approve in this deal. The delay is this the third now since the settlement was reached in December. Apparently, Judge Robertson has had it, and the tribes have also. And now, of course, as you can hear, Trey Arrow is with us today, as he is every Friday. Good morning, Trey.
Good morning. How are you doing,
Chris? We're doing well, and thanks so much for being with us. It's been a whole week now of talk about hemp, industrial hemp, and the changes. We talked briefly last week about hemp. What are some of the factoids that you have at your fingertips that people may not be aware of?
Well, you know, the thing is that the Emperor Wears No Clothes is a great account of a lot of the political the political ideology as to why hemp is illegal. And I think if people haven't checked out that book, to please do so. You know, there's really no reason why. No logical reason except for government and corporate conspiracy and corruption as to why hemp is illegal.
It's a hardy plant. It requires no pesticides, no herbicides. It doesn't deplete the soil. It's astonishing. There is no real valid reason why we're not growing it now.
No, you know, and there's a lot of statistics about, you know, like 1 acre of hemp can yield just as much paper as 4 acres of 20-year-old trees. So, you know, for deforestation issues, for health issues, you know, hemp seed is a complete protein. It's very, very healthy for turning hemp into paper instead of using trees, and certainly for all kinds of clothing. That's one of the reasons why it was made illegal, is because it was rivaling cotton for the number one crop. So, and of course, nylon was coming out, the synthetic, you know, oil-dependent fabrics. So there are many, many reasons as to why it's illegal, and certainly the more that people get aware and plugged into the issues, then the stronger the chance that we can actually legalize it.
We do have a law. We passed a law in Oregon last August, I believe, that did legalize it in the state. We're waiting for the federal government to get on board. Mm-hmm. Speaking too about the food angle and the nutritional value of hemp. Let's talk with Hans Foster of Living Harvest, someone who knows something about it. Good morning, Hans.
Good morning, Chris.
Thank you so much for joining us. You are the moving force behind Living Harvest. Talk a little bit about hemp's value as a food source.
Well, hemp is an incredible food source. It's we like to look at it as a superfood, and hemp actually sort of is a solution to many people's problems out there when it comes down to dietary restrictions. It's extremely healthful. It has high quality of protein, all 10 essential amino acids, and then it's high in naturally occurring omega-3s and 6s. And then, of course, on top of that, as you were talking about earlier, it is, you know, a completely sustainable crop.
So you are the living harvest force. How did you found out these things about hemp, and then you started this company, and also more than a company, really a source of information about hemp and an active effort to set people straight and inform the public of the beneficial effect of using hemp as a food source. How did you start Living Harvest?
Well, it's unfortunately I cannot take credibility all myself, and it's the whole team of people here, you know, that are very passionate about what we're doing, and hopefully not only try to give people options for healthier diets, but then also while we're doing that, trying to do something positive for our planet and our community around it. But yeah, there's lots of problems out there with people that have either dietary restrictions, that have allergens towards soy, dairy, and others. And, you know, hemp is a great option for them. As far as we know, we have not seen any allergens toward the product. And, you know, we just basically provide people, you know, with very healthy options.
Hans, thanks so much. We've got Trey Arrow here with us today, too. We haven't begun to touch on all of the topics, but you have a great website. It's extremely informative. Listeners can go to livingharvest.com and get more information about what Hans has been doing and providing to the public, both in terms of a product and in terms of information, education, and new options. Again, thank you so much. My guest has been Hans Foster. We have Trey Arrow here, of course, with music today, bringing the subject to a different level.
Aside from the cars, my car has two wheels with handlebars.
Cascadia for Friday, April 9th, 2010. Engineering is Todd Wilson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBU AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. Trey Arrow is our guest in the studio, and I'm Liam Delton.
You've been listening to Headlines, Commentary, and Music from Air Cascadia on KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.FM on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Now stay tuned for Flashpoint. Massey Mining Company and the safety violations leading up to the disaster in West Virginia, and labor activists discuss what we can learn from the Toyota plant in California closing.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support, and have a good day.
Today on Flashpoints will feature an extended report on the failure of the government and the Massey Coal Mining Company to protect its workers. And we'll also look at the recent closing of the NUMMI Toyota plant in California. That's an interesting story. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Now we turn our attention to the situation in West Virginia. In West Virginia, mining officials and politicians are using the word miracle to describe the chances of saving the four remaining miners trapped deep underground in the Massey coal mine. Meanwhile, an article published today in the Washington Independent shows that the Massey company, which just killed 25 of its workers and perhaps a bunch more, owns a number of mines that have accumulated hundreds, if not thousands, of citations, and the company has been cited many times just in the past year alone. That's the year that Obama was president. Even as the men remain trapped and virtually hopeless underground, the CEO of Massey, Don Blankenship, maintains Massey's concern for workers' safety. Blankenship has been a combative advocate for the industry and likes to brag about the bullet that was shot through his old Zenith television by someone who didn't agree with his policies. He calls himself a street fighter, and he clearly has not relented in his claims that the company has a high regard for the miners' safety. As we go to air, rescue teams continue to wait to go into the mine again, as at the moment they are unable to enter because of large amounts of methane gas that may explode at any moment. Joining us to talk about the situation is Jim Lewis. Jim Lewis is a spokesperson with the United Mine Workers Safety Group. Also with us is Jeff Biggers, author of Reckoning at Eagle Creek. Let me begin with you, if I could, Jim Lewis. We're hearing now about hundreds, if not thousands, of violations, violations that came down in the last year. Tell us, the plan says, and if you read the spin, the coal industry was on skyrocketing, going in the positive direction, if you look at the charts in terms of safety, accidents. So everybody is shocked about what happened. Your response.
Yeah, sure. First, let me set the record straight. I'm an Episcopal minister, retired here in Charleston, done a lot of my ministry here in Charleston. Came here off of a lot of work on the Delmarva Peninsula working with poultry workers. Just want to set that straight. I've done a lot of work with the mine workers, United Mine Workers of America. Going to jail a couple times with them. But I'm here now in Charleston and close to the scene. A lot of stuff to say about Massey. I'll make it quick. It's a company that is an atrocious company. It's been environmentally a mess, messing up with the mountaintop removal here, messing up our streams, taking the tops off our mountains. In terms of the worker situation that you've got, which we've got on the mine right now, this company has had enormous citations, 1,342 safety violations from 2005 through to Monday. They paid almost $2 million in proposed fines. And over the past, just since March, there's been 12 serious ventilation violations in this mine, 8 of them for failure to follow a ventilation plan and for not enough air being put into the active mining area. So it's a time bomb. It was a time bomb ready to go off. And this company, Don Blankenship, who's the CEO, is this is long, lots of stories, a throwback to the old coal barons here in West Virginia. So it's a company that has beaten up on labor. You try and organize there, you're in big time trouble. And it's just been an atrocious company. Blankenship itself has put millions of dollars into the legislative lobbying here. Grisham's book about Supreme Court justices on a local level was really based out of this place here, where Blankenship put millions of dollars to get a Supreme Court justice that would be favorable to his rulings in coal. So this is a guy. I just came from a rally that we had at the Capitol, I talked to folks there, I won't mention names, but they said, you know, it's a terrible thing when we lose these miners. It's a terrible kind of sacrifice. It's awful. But maybe now something will happen in terms of Don Blankenship, because he's been atrocious for so long, and this company has just run right over the environment and the men and women who live here.
Give us a sense of just some of the people on the ground who are directly affected, who you've been speaking with. What does it look like from the ground up? Blankenship says the company cares. He's been out there. Of course, he was booed a couple of times. I suspect that there are many people who are quite angry with him.
Well, the anger is building, and more than that, the anger is building. In fact, when he came to the other day to address them and tell the people there about the deaths, people booed him, and a chair was thrown. And it's getting more of that now. What you're seeing now, and I think this will be of great interest to you, what you're seeing now is with the media in here, the media in here, with the television, you're seeing now workers who are shaded, you can't see who they are, they're speaking, and they're saying, look, this mine's been a problem, it has been a problem, been afraid to speak. We were afraid to lose our jobs, we were afraid of what it would do to our community, but now they're beginning to speak. So that's the mood right now. Of course, the mood is always right now trying to get these other four miners out of there. We hope this evening to be able to get news on that. But so people are praying, they are they're holding on to one another, they're still hoping for what they call a miracle, that these four workers will come out. But let me tell you, that will dissipate quickly, and is already beginning to, as they focus on Massey and the safety violations and what their men have been under with this company.
Well, you know, it also might take a miracle for the mining industry and somebody like Blankenship, who is really a bulldog for the industry, to make a change. I want to bring into the discussion Jim Biggers. He has written a piece that appeared this week in Common Dreams just a couple of days ago. It's called Who Killed the Miners? Profits Over Safety. Let me just read a little bit of this, Mr. Biggers, then I want to ask you to jump in. You write, all coal mining safety laws have been written in miners' blood. My grandfather, who barely survived an explosion in a coal mine in southern Illinois, taught me this phrase. He also taught me about the 150-year-old battle in the coal fields over reckless production at the cost of responsible safety measures. As our prayers and condolences go out to the many coal mining families in Raleigh County, West Virginia, I think about the needless safety violations and subsequent disasters that have taken place over the past century. Over 104,000 Americans and immigrants have died in the coal mines. According to one inspector, many, if not a majority, of those accidents should not have been considered mishaps, but acts of negligent homicide. Jim Biggers, you've been in touch with a bunch of the people on the ground. Your first impressions and response to what you heard and the fact that Massey cares about its workers.
Well, I think first and foremost, what I've heard from so many different coal mining widows and coal miners and people who live in the Coal River Valley, where I've done a lot of work, is that they expected this disaster to happen long ago. You know, that a crisis really is never a crisis unless it's validated by disaster. And we've known for a long time we've had a crisis, not only with regulatory violations, but the way we inspect our mines and the way we follow through with penalties to make sure that unsafe mines are shut down. And so I think that's what's really been the saddest part of this tragedy, is everybody knew this was going to happen and it shouldn't have happened, and therefore I think we really need to hold someone accountable for ultimately the criminal act that allowed 25, if not more, people to die.
So does that mean Blankenship mass murder trial?
I don't know what it means. Of course, we have to go through the investigations to find out the true cause. But when we know that there's 500 violations in a single year, like last year, and that 47 of them are what we call unwarrantable failures, which really are serious infractions, you know, life and death matters, and we allow these to happen, and we allow a mine to continue working, and the coal company openly and admittedly allows a mine to operate in an unsafe fashion, then I think we really are talking about a situation of regulated manslaughter at the very least. You know, I'll just go ahead and stop with that.
And just in terms of the current administration, I know that the Secretary of Labor canceled the trip to, I guess, the West Coast to help talk about some job-related terror there. She said to manage closely the situation in West Virginia. But frankly, I haven't seen her managing much. Where has she been?
Well, meaning this today, President Obama, for example, released a statement that they will be meeting next week, and he expects to have an investigation handed before him and some sort of initial report from the Secretary of Labor, as well as Joe Main, who just took over in October as head of MSHA, which is the Mine Safety, the Mine Health Safety Administration. And the truth is, you know, they're recovering from many years under the Bush administration, when the Mine Health Safety Administration really was gutted, when so many people from the coal lobby and coal executives were put in positions of power within the government to monitor the coal industry. And so you had your classic fox, you know, tending the hen house. And so I think, you know, we do have to say that the Obama administration has been working to make strides to recover so much of the regulatory negligence we've had for many years. But it's just simply not enough. And let me give you some really specific examples. You know, we only have quarterly inspections of these mines in most states, like West Virginia. That's only four times a year. And this is a policy we've had since 1969, and it's simply not enough. And at the same time, we have a policy that allows a federal inspector to go in to cite violations, and then the coal company has a right to contest them in court. And they can string these things out for months, if not years. And in this particular mine that had the disaster, not only did they have 500 violations in this last year, but they tripled their coal production while they were doing it. And this is the kind of regulatory mismanagement we have to stop, and we have to clamp down on, and we have to say enough is enough, and we can't let this go on anymore.
Okay, this is Steve Zeltzer, and I'm co-hosting the show, and welcome to both of you. One of the things that people are asking is, in the Sago mine disaster, there was an act that was passed in 2006 to protect miners. What happened to that act, and why wasn't it being enforced? I understand that mines can be shut down if there are serious health problems, health and safety problems, yet this didn't wasn't done. By the investigators, Jim, can or Jeff, could you answer that?
Well, I mean, I think that's some of the questions are going to have to be answered in this violation. I mean, there are certain things from the Miners Act that have been implemented. For example, rescue chambers, which were little areas which were cordoned off that had food and oxygen and water in case of disasters. But I think you brought up a good point, is if we do have laws on the books that say mines should shut down if they have been cited for certain levels of violations until they actually amend them, then we have to really ask that question, why this didn't happen. And I think that will be part of the investigation that precedes this.
Yeah, Jim Lewis, I've been talking to a woman whose family's been in, a granddaughter of a miner, also one working Union Carbide, watched her grandfather die with black lung, said goodbye to him on her sixth birthday, all kinds of cancers. People should go to jail over this. And folks on the media now are very careful about how they say, well, how could this happen? Where did it go wrong? Well, it goes wrong right up to the very top, right into the government here. And regulations are not being enforced, both environmentally and as far as workers' injuries and safety issues. They're just not being done because the way business gets done here, and particularly with Massey, this huge company, is that the deals are made and corners are cut. And the boys get by on it. So we're hopeful. We're hopeful that Joe Manchin will be able to come in, and he knows the story. Come on now, let's get it out in the open. I wrote my little piece. It went out all over that the governor should close down. And I got a lot of response to this. The governor should close down the Massey mines right now. Right now. I have so many drive-in tickets or trip problems with drinking. They take my license. Somebody in business here who is violating the law a couple of times, the business closes. What goes on?
Well, you know, if somebody dies tomorrow or next week or when they reopen the mine in 10 days or whenever, everybody, the administration in power now, the union of, well, there's no union there, so we don't have to worry about that. They know now. They can't say they didn't know. Doesn't the administration have the power now? Doesn't Hilda Solis have the power now to say,
as she claimed. I'm taking control. I'm not going to let another human being go down in that mine until we get rid of these 500, 2,000, 2,500, whatever violations. Does she have the power? Can she enforce?
Oh, yeah, certainly she has the power. But I just want to give you another example of how a level of oversight is still occurring. You know, part of this crisis is really the tip of the iceberg of really the dirty aspects of the coal industry. You know, every day, 3 coal miners die from black lung disease.
Yeah.
And 1,000 people every year, 1,000 coal miners every year dying from black lung, 10,000 in the last decade. And this is a disease which we recognized in 1831. We did nothing about it until we had the disaster in Farmington, West Virginia in 1968, and Richard Nixon was forced to sign this law. And coal miners like my grandfather suffered with us for years, but we've lost over 250,000 coal miners from black lung alone. And yet it's something that is completely preventable. You know, and we have black lung for the same reason we have these disasters taking place today, is that people are cutting corners on our regulations and rules, and they're simply not being enforced. And black lung, to me, is really one of the great scandals that we're not enforcing. And it's, once again, it's something we're waiting for the Obama administration to step up to the plate and finally deal with something that should have been dealt with many, many years ago.
Well, the question I have to both of you is, we have Obama administration, we have a labor secretary, which is lauded by the trade union movement as a great advocate of workers. The president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, is a miner, came from the mines, and yet the unions are not calling for criminal sanctions. They're not calling for the shutdown of the mine. Has the AFL-CIO, where is it? It seems like it's missing in action. Here's a criminal, a real terrorist, who's terrorized the miners, forced them to go to work where it's not safe, and yet he's doing business as usual and playing the game again that he's doing things right.
Jeff, you want to take a crack at that? I'd like a crack at it at some point, but I'd like to hear you on this.
All right, go for it, guys.
Well, you know, as someone, once again, who my grandfather was part of the union movement here and really reminded me of the bloodshed that was lost in order to have an eight-hour workday as early as the 1870s to actually have workplace safety mechanisms that they suffered for and fought for. You know, one of the worst accidents ever to take place was just up the road from us in southern Illinois in 1950, where, once again, it was a methane gas explosion that needlessly happened and took 119 lives. And we began the process of having a Mine Safety Act. But the truth is, the unions have been shattered. You know, less than 20% of the mine workers now are connected to the United Mine Workers.
Right.
And it's probably more like 15%. And therefore, you know, they just don't have any power anymore. And they finally today had a statement, of course, of outrage on this disaster. And as we all know, these disasters only take place in non-union mines, that a union boss, a union fire boss, would be right there and wouldn't stand for 50 violations, let alone any of these violations. And so I think that is part of another truth that's starting to emerge here, is the incredible cost to coal miners by, you know, basically betraying and giving up on the unions.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think, too, that right now, at this moment, the people, some folks are waiting to pounce, because right now the focus is on getting those four miners out or finding out what's going on there. So that's where the focus is. And I think the mine workers will pounce. They are depleted in their strength and energy, and I know that. The thing that Jeff said earlier, too, about the Labor Department, I worked 7 years with poultry workers on the Eastern Shore, met with Mrs. Chow at one point with religious leaders. It was so bad. The ergonomics stuff was thrown out, everything, and so it's going to take a little time to get things up and running, if they get up and running. And I do think maybe this is the moment. Obama's made some good appointments. I think Joe Maine is a good appointment. So the things have been so bad, we've got to get to it. But
and let's just be clear.
People should go to jail over this.
They
should go to jail.
And just to inform people, we're talking about a company that controls over 41 other coal mines, I believe you mentioned this, with over 2,074 violations in 41 mines. Now, I guess the Secretary of Labor knows, the President knows, it's all documented, it's all legal. Why won't we set an example, shut them down? What really, truly is stopping the protection of the people and the workers here? Jim?
Yeah, I think that, first off, the media, let me go back there for a second. The media comes in, they did the SAGO, and they covered it hard, and then they leave, and things are back to normal. I hope I'm not naive with this. I think this is a critical moment. And a blanket ship is not coming across well in the media right now. And I think that we're going to see some serious changes.
But he never has come across. Everybody knows he's a cutthroat. He's proud. He brags about being a street fighter. And he keeps the television that somebody shot through in his office because it's a talking piece. So that's not changing.
Yeah, but you say everybody. But most people don't know what's going on in Appalachia. They really don't know. And they don't know much about West Virginia.
Yeah,
they don't know where the coal, what the coal's all about. They don't know. You mentioned mountaintop removal to people, and many folks don't know. Well, this is that moment, I think. I really do believe it is. And so we'll see.
Well, the question, again, we have to go back to is, where is Hilda Solis? Why hasn't she issued a statement, I mean, of the need to revigorate the agency, the need to make sure that people, if they did not do their job, were held responsible in the administration? Where is the new director, Joe Maine? Where is his strong statement? Where is Richard Trumka, who's a minor? I mean, are they calling for criminal penalties? Are they putting Obama on the spot and saying, this has to stop, we can't allow this again? I don't hear the outrage from the AFL-CIO, from the national leadership, this is another accident.
Well, Jeff, will it take 2,000 more violations? Again, how many violations does it take to get a progressive Secretary of Labor who says she loves, who comes from the unions, we know she does, how many violations and how many deaths before somebody who loves us and supports our work and workers is going to act? Again, I'm not being facetious, but it's fairly amazing.
It is amazing. It is absolutely amazing.
And I think we have great hopes to see what happens next week, you know, when they do meet with President Obama. If the meeting happens and we never hear about it again, if there's no hearings in Congress, you remember Crandall Canyon when they brought Bob Murray, of course, before Congress in the hearing to testify, and they grilled him, and ultimately he had criminal investigation as well. If we don't have that same thing happen in this situation, it's hard to imagine it won't happen, then I think, you know, there is going to be a situation that we have to make it clear this is unacceptable with the administration. I personally have higher hopes that they will step forward now and use this as an example to begin to crack down on what I refer to as outlaws in the coal industry.
All right. Well, I want to give each of you 30 seconds. Let's start with you, Jeff. If you had the Secretary of Labor's ear, what would your advice be?
Well, my advice, technical advice, is we need more than just quarterly inspections. The second thing is we need to begin the process of a just transition in the coal fields, because this is the real crisis. Is coal production slumping? Now we're relying on these outlaw companies to do most of our production. And we need to recognize that coal miners have to have a future too, that coal field communities who have carried the burden for 200 years have to have a future too, and we need to begin the just transition to a clean energy future. And that means these green jobs we hear so much about, these clean energy jobs and investments, new manufacturing of wind turbines and solar panels, all this kind of activity in the Labor Department and with the new green economy has to begin in the coal fields. And we need to make the coal fields ground zero for a clean energy revolution.
30 seconds, Jim Lewis.
Yeah, I would second that. I'd say this. Blankenship was here for a huge meeting here in Charleston. Robert Kennedy debated him. He said, Blankenship, his own words, said, it's impossible to do this this work in the mines without breaking the law. He said that here. All right, I'd say to the Secretary of Labor right now, close down all Massey operations at this moment, because other miners are going into the mines right now, and they could go just as sour as this one went. Close them down and force an investigation immediately. And clean this industry up. They're burying over a thousand streams in this area, dropping mercury and all sorts of heavy metals in. It's not just black lung anymore. Close them down until we use this industry, Massey, to see what's wrong with mining today in this country.
Jim Biggers, Jeff Biggers, Jim Lewis, want to thank you both very much for very enlightening, in-depth discussion on the situation happening in West Virginia now, by the way. And they're still waiting. I don't know if they've tried to go back in the mines again, but they're talking about enough methane gas piled up in there for another explosion. So obviously, this is an everyday problem at probably every one of these mines. We thank you both for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and I'm here with Steve Zeltzer. And before we go to the next segment, we're going to talk about the closing down of the NUMMI Toyota plant. But you had one final comment you wanted to...
Yeah, I was going to make a very important point that the listener audience should be aware of, and that is George Miller is chair of the Labor and Education Committee, and Lynn Woolsey.
Have they spoken up about that?
I haven't heard. In fact, we tried to get George Miller on the program today. He was in Europe at a global warming conference. But the anger and the frustration and, you know, what is happening in the fields doesn't seem to be evidence from either of these two people. And they're in charge of the government congressional agency responsible for oversight on the mine agency and what's going on for workers in the United States.
Any comments from Nancy Pelosi?
We haven't heard a word from her.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We're going to keep talking about unions. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That's Steve Zeltzer. We're going to take a musical break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the closing of that plant. Stay with us.
Dig and dig and dig 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 my life away, oh, and dig my life away. Precious metal is hard to find, precious metal is hard to find, down in the hole and down in the mine, I dig my life away, oh, and I dig my life away. Perfect ruby is hard to find, perfect ruby is hard to find, down in the gold slice and shine, and I dig my life away, oh, well, I dig my life away. Good shaped diamonds hard to find, good shaped diamonds hard to find, go in the hole both day and night, and I dig my life away, oh, and I dig my life away. Dig and dig and dig 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 my life away, oh, well, I dig my life away. Nice round pearls hard to find, nice round pearls hard to find, dive to the bottom and feel around, and I dig my life away, oh, well, I dig my life away. Old Sam Digger is hard to find, old Sam Digger is hard to find, drink my wine with pickle and brine, and dig my life away, oh, and I dig my life away. Nice shaped woman is hard to find, nice shaped woman is hard to find, roll them down the mountainside, and I dig my life away, oh, and I dig my life away. Dig, 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 and I dig my life away, oh, and I dig my life away.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. And we're going to continue talking about the plight of workers under very difficult conditions, very difficult times. And anybody who lives in California, really, or any worker who has any connection to the auto industry knows that the shutdown of the Yumi Toyota plant here in California was not a good sign. And there are many things about it that leave us wondering. And joining us to talk about what happened there, and maybe to help us understand a little bit more, crucial story, is in the studio, Barry Shepherd. He is actually the husband of an activist auto worker, correct?
And, correct.
And he writes about, union writes about this company. And joining us on the telephone is Juan Castillo. He is with the United Auto, we hope that he's going to be joining us soon. He's with the United Auto Workers, 2244 Executive Board Number, and we're going to call his phone number again and see if we can track him down. And in the studio is Steve Zeltzer. He's helping me put together some labor segments, and I very much appreciate that as well. Now, let me start with you, Steve. Just set the scene. Remind people what happened. What are the basics here?
Well, this NUMMI plant used to be a General Motors plant, and there was a lot of labor struggles at that plant, and it was closed down by General Motors. And what happened was is Toyota and GM were urged to take it over and to bring in the Toyota method of operation. And this was a labor management partnership, team members, and the workers who were hired back, and they did screen some of the militants out of that plant, agreed to go along with the Toyota team plan. And that team, they went to Japan, they were trained, and they were promised that if they followed the procedure, the Toyota procedure, they would have a job as long as they were able to sell cars. And that was the history of that plant. And that plant actually had the highest production records of any Toyota plant in the world. I mean, in their truck line, for example, they had 0.05% errors in production. So you're talking about a highly skilled workforce who went along with the company, and now they were told that it was going to be closed and that their jobs were going to be shut down.
Juan Castillo, from your perspective, in the union, executive board member on UAW 2244, if the plant was doing so well, what happened?
I think that there's different reasons why, and mainly I see their main fault being on General Motors. They had the option to rebadge the Vive, and they chose to include the NUMMI plan into their bankruptcy. And that began the closure of the plant, leaving Toyota with the whole business to run.
And did the union do the right thing? Was everything done that could be done to save the plant? How did the workers, were the workers surprised? Talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, I'm being a strong critic about the union and their involvement in the plant closure, because going back to General Motors, when they were going through their bankruptcy, that was the time when the union, the politicians, everybody had to get out there and make sure that General Motors was not going to include NUMMI into their bankruptcy. They did nothing at that time. And even after General Motors, they pulled out, you know, in the middle of the night, one weekend, and leaving Toyota with the whole plant. The union still didn't do anything for 2 months. We were in limbo because Toyota did not make the decision for 2 months whether they're going to take over the plant, the whole entire plant, or withdraw. And that was our window of opportunity for us to go out there and rally and fight and try to get all our allies to put pressure on Toyota and General Motors to continue doing business in California, and they didn't.
And, Juan, I mean, there are not just your membership, 5,000, nearly 5,000 auto workers, but suppliers, 50,000 workers who are really supplying the plant. And there was no major mobilization, no mass protest of the workers in the community. But in addition to that, weren't membership meetings canceled by the union?
Yeah, I mean, the union, the leadership of our local union, tried everything in their power to make sure that there was not going to be any meetings whatsoever. What I mean by that is they schedule meetings at times where on Sundays after the production, second shift production, Saturdays, where it made it impossible for people to be able to show up to the meetings. They did not advertise the meetings. On the December meeting, it was November, it ran into the holiday. So usually what in past practice, we just reschedule those meetings and the leadership, in the executive board, we made a motion to reschedule that meeting, and the president didn't want to do that. So they tried everything in their power to make sure that people would not show up at the meetings. They did not want to have a discussion about what was going on in the plant.
Why?
They did not, the membership got very, they were making a lot of questions. How come we're not asking for General Motors to help us out? How come we're only talking about Toyota? How come General Motors is being left out of the Toyota discussion? They did not want to hear that.
Well, again, what was the leadership and the interests of the leadership of the union different, do you believe, than the worker level, the
rank and file?
The rank and file?
Absolutely. I mean, in my opinion, the UAW, they wanted General Motors to pull out, and I believe that they wanted the plant to shut down. And that's my opinion. I didn't see them mobilizing at all. When Toyota was left with the whole plant, then that's when the UAW started mobilizing, but attacking Toyota only. And that's when the recall deals came up with Toyota. And you started seeing the market share shipped nowhere to Ford at that time. And I believe that was their whole strategy. They wanted to destroy Toyota's reputation in order to shift those sales over to the big three. And that's where the UAW benefits, since they have 17.5% ownership on General Motors, and also the Obama administration as well.
Let me bring you into this discussion, Barry Shepherd. You've written a lot about this. Your wife works for the company. What do you think happened here?
Well, maybe we should back up a little bit to go into the union nationally, what's happened to the UAW nationally, and then come back a little forward.
Take a minute. We don't have a ton of time, so
yeah.
How are we...
Right. It's just the leadership of the UAW nationally has been on a concessions kick since the middle of the 1980s. And there's been concessions after concessions after concessions with the big three. The NUMMI plant actually had a better contract because they weren't synchronous with the other contracts. But the what happened in this plant was that there was a shift away from the administration caucus, which is what the international caucus calls itself. In 2003, a new leadership came in that threw out this administration caucus, which was very cozy with the company. And so there was a period when this new leadership actually did some things that were quite good. In 2005, during the contract negotiations, the company tried to cut the benefits completely. And the whole union mobilized. There was thousands of people who signed up to strike, picket. There were demonstrations outside the plant, which Toyota didn't like because they like to pretend to the public that they have just a wonderful relationship with their workers.
So what happened here? I got to cut to the quick. What happened?
Okay, so this leadership then lost its way. That's what happened.
Can I intervene real quick on that one, on that note?
All right.
What is interesting, looking back, is yes, you're talking about the United Alliance leadership. The two top leaders, the president and the chairman, Victor Quesada and George Nano, they were both offered jobs to the International Union, so they left. And the people who replaced them was Javier Contreras and Sergio Santos, who are, in my opinion, they're just yes men. And all they did was follow whatever the International Union was telling them to do.
We've got 2 minutes. I'm going to give you the minute, and then Steve a minute.
Okay. So that this was a development, though, what Juan is talking about.
Yeah, it was a development.
I said they changed, and they were originally opposed to the international leadership, and now have come along and completely capitulated to it. And just one final thing. This is really a blow to California, not just to these 4,700 UAW workers, but to all the workers in the supply plants. Where I live in Hayward, a plant just of 400 is just shut down on April 1st because of the shutdown of NUMMI, and it's throughout the country. But this comes on top of the tremendous blows that California has received. We have a high unemployment rate of 12% already. This is going to increase it. We have a catastrophe with education and all kinds of other social services being cut back. So this is really an important blow to us here in this state.
Barry Shepherd, Steve Zeltz, final
word. One of the things that is very important to understand is that the union did have protests, but they protested at the Japanese consulate. They protested at the dealerships. And the members, from what I understand from Juan and others, didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't see that, and it came too late. The other thing is that I interviewed Bob King, who's the incoming president of the UAW, and he said that they had offered the $14 an hour, the same concession deal as they offered at General Motors and at Ford, and that had been rejected by Toyota. Juan and other leaders of the union in the local didn't even know about that. They had not been told that the international made this kind of offer to keep the plant there. Lastly, the UAW leadership at the local plant has signed a secrecy agreement that they can't even talk about Toyota and what happened. So what kind of a union is it that would sign a secrecy agreement and say, we can't talk about what happened at our plant, and we have to go along with this retention? The last point, and very important, there were 600 workers there, 500 to 600 workers who were injured on the job. Many of them have serious injuries. Their body is torn up. They have back problems. These workers were discriminated against in the retention settlement. They got less money than other workers because they could not go back in the plant. So here, the public is going to pay for the cost of that. And these injured workers on Memorial Day, talking about miners, these auto workers have been facing the brunt of these attacks.
Steve Zeltzer, thank you. We thank our guests.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we're out of time, but we're going to bring you back. We're going to keep talking about this. We thank all of you for joining us. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's it for Flashpoints.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.